Well, hello, good morning, and welcome to Money Talk. It's Friday the 8th of August, we're in 2014, and we're at Haglands in Dymchurch, where the weather is decidedly dodgy. There's no rain, but it's very overcast, but the place is as busy as I have ever seen it. Good morning, my name is Simon Webster. For my sins, I'm the Managing Director of Facts and Figures. We're Chartered Financial Planners based in Ashford. And my job over the next hour is to elucidate the world of financial services just a little bit and hopefully share some of the experiences I've picked up over the last 30 years that will help you make informed financial decisions in the weeks, months and even years to go to come on. I make no apology today for returning to that old chestnut, retirement. It is a huge issue for all of us. We're all getting older and we've got to do something about it. And earlier this year, George Osborne's budget introduced huge changes to the way that we can take pension income from defined contribution or money purchase pensions. And this will have a profound impact on the lives of just about everybody. His changes were set against a background of our ageing population, something I banged on about a lot in earlier shows. We're all living longer, and it's coupled with dramatic falls in annuity rates, and I'll talk about just how dramatic in a second. Those in final salary pension schemes have largely been insulated from these issues, as the extra costs of meeting historic pension promises fall on the employer, and ultimately the pension protection fund. But even those in final salary pensions have seen a slowing in the rate at which future pension benefits build up. This is called the accrual rate. And in previous programmes, we've discussed the industrial unrest that this has caused. It is also worth noting that many final salary pensions are now closed to new members, as companies find they just cannot meet the ever-increasing costs. But for those in money purchase or defined contribution type pensions, the impact of falling annuity rates has been dramatic. In November 1990, the annuity rate for a male aged 65 on a level, single life basis and with a 5-year guarantee was 15.64%. That meant that if you were lucky enough to retire with, say, a pension pot of £100,000, then you could look forward to an annual income for the rest of your life of £15,640 per annum. However, the annuity rate today for someone retiring on exactly the same basis is just 5.5%. So someone who had worked just as hard for just as long and who had saved just as carefully would receive an income of just £5,500 per annum for the rest of their lives. That's two-thirds less than the predecessor retiring only a few years earlier. The obvious question to ask at this point is, why is it that annuity rates have fallen so far over the last 25 years? Fundamentally, it's because as annuities promise a long-term income, their funds have had to be secured against investments that deliver a long-term secure income. And the only realistic source of such guaranteed long-term income has been deemed to be gilts. Now, I was taught in accountancy many, many years ago that the word deemed means let's pretend. So the whole investment world has sort of bought into the world, bought into the story that gilts are the only way of producing a secure income. And I suppose in many ways that is actually true. Gilts are effectively loan notes issued by the government and are seen as being extremely secure because they're government-backed and they're long-term investments producing a strong underlying income. But are they? Let's now compare the returns enjoyed by people in different asset classes over the last 63 years from 1950 to the end of 2013. But here's a benchmark. If you put £100 aside on the 1st of January 1950, in the period to the 31st of December 2013, that £100 would have needed to grow to £2,974 just to keep pace with inflation. So it would have needed to have multiplied its value by nearly 30 just to be able to buy the same amount of stuff at the end of 2013 as one could have bought at the beginning of 1950. If you'd put your £100 into gilts in 1950, the capital value of those gilts would now be 73 quid. But the good news is that gilts produce income, and so the cumulative effect of reinvesting all the income over that period between 1950 and 2013 would have meant that your basket of gilts would have been worth £10,017. So that's not too bad. If you put the same £100 in a UK Building Society account, it would only have been worth £5,526. So Building Society account, £5,526. Not quite half, well, just over half of what the gilts would have been worth. But now it gets interesting. If you'd invested that same £100 into UK stocks and shares in 1950, they would have been worth £10,017 by the end of 2013. And had you reinvested the income produced by those shares as well, over the whole period, your share portfolio would have been worth a staggering 153,338 quid. So, in summary, £100 invested in 1950 would have needed to grow to £2,974 to keep pace with inflation. It would have been worth £5,526 deposited with the Building Society. Gilts with income reinvested were worth £7,255, while shares with income reinvested were worth £153,338. My question for you is, which one do you think was best? And it raises the question, are gilts really such a secure long-term investment after all? Security that offers little protection isn't really worth very much at all. Now, mindful of both declining gilt yields and the fact that pensioners were probably going to live 20, 30 or even 40 years from retirement, the government decided to try and investigate ways whereby retirees could benefit from the significantly higher returns potentially available from these riskier investment classes. In this example, we've been looking at shares. It's become clear to them that the cost of the very limited guarantee provided by gilts or annuities have become far too high. And as we've said, a guarantee that doesn't offer very much is hardly worth having. As you can imagine, people drawing their pensions had never been best pleased with this situation. So in 1995, pension income drawdown was introduced, and this negated the need to purchase an annuity altogether. The idea of pension income drawdown is quite simple. Throughout our working lives, people contribute to pensions, and that money is invested. So now, instead of disinvesting and buying an annuity at retirement, the government gave people the option of leaving their pension invested and effectively drawing an income from the investment returns on their plans direct. When it was introduced in 1995, there was huge concern in government circles that the public could not be trusted to control the rate at which they extracted money from their pensions, and this could ultimately lead to extra demands on the state as people simply ran out of money in retirement, having blown their pension pot in the early years. So with typical government thinking and a huge amount of complexity, they attempted to limit the amount of incomes that retirees could draw. And initially, the maximum was set to be broadly equivalent to 150% of the equivalent annuity that could have been purchased instead. So retirees could now draw an income at a rate that suited them, which was great, except it was later reduced to 120%. But it did effectively give people the chance to get a higher initial income, but not too much higher, minimising the chance that people would run out of money in retirement. It also gave people the chance to perhaps take lower incomes earlier in retirement if they decided to carry on working part-time and they only wanted to draw part of their pension in the early years of retirement. Again, the concern has always been that people would take out too much money and leave themselves short later in retirement, possibly expecting the state to pick up the tab for their earlier profligacy. A few years ago, the government introduced the concept of flexible drawdown. And whereas previous drawdown pension arrangements had always been capped, those with regular income in excess of £20,000 were now allowed to take as much as they wanted from their pension. But clearly that option was only available to rich people, people who had that fixed £20,000 income. And the point to bear in mind, which comes back to bite effectively after the budget again, is that if you take income out of your pension and you've already got £20,000, at today's rates, broadly speaking, higher rate tax bites at £40,000 income. So if you take £20,000 in addition to the £20,000 you've already got, anything over that, higher rate tax. So it's not necessarily a sound move to start taking money out of a pension and paying that higher rate tax. Now, the annuity rate that the whole pension industry had to reference when setting how much pension people could draw from their drawdown arrangements was determined by the improbably named Government Actuaries Department. Yes, even the government has an actuarial department. I was surprised too. This so-called GAD rate became the reference point for all capped drawdown calculations, and everyone in drawdown has to have their income reviewed every 3 years to make sure that they were not extracting too much money from their plans, because the GAD rate references the value of the plan and the age of the person drawing the income. So if, for example, investment returns have been very poor, then somebody could find themselves with a capped drawdown limit rather lower than they were used to. Of course, if investment returns have been very good, they might find themselves able to take rather more than they were used to. But it is a factor to bear in mind. George Osborne's long-term strategy, announced in the 2014 budget, was to allow retirees to decide how much income they wanted to take, and then to let them take it. This part of his plan only comes into effect from March 2015, to give the pensions industry a chance to put the necessary IT into place, because, of course, he announced this. It was a little bit of a bombshell. We were all very pleased. I think everybody in financial services and everybody who thinks about pensions was very pleased with the announcement. But the problem, of course, is delivering it. And as nobody was expecting this, the industry had to go back and reprogram its computers to cope with what George Osborne was promising. In fact, to this day, I'm only aware of one company that can pay out a monthly drawdown income of a flexible amount. We'll come on to that later. In the budget, to make sure that he didn't lose too much day one in terms of publicity, he did introduce some increased and improved interim arrangements. The capped drawdown maximum income limit increased back to 150% of GAD for pension years starting on or after the 27th of March 2014. So anybody whose pension came up for review at that point could increase their pension by up to 30%. Huge win. And the flexible drawdown minimum income requirement reduced from £20,000 to £12,000 for all new arrangements effected from the 27th of March 2014. In other words, if you'd had an income of, say, £15,000 or £16,000 before the budget, you only had the choice of annuity or cap drawdown. But now, courtesy of the budget's interim proposals, you were earning enough, or deemed to be earning enough, to qualify for flexible drawdown. And that gives you a huge amount of flexibility and a lot of retirement options that a lot of people find very attractive. So what are the implications of these changes? I think we'll discuss these after this break. We'll be right back.
due to respect, he could get out while he can. We always need to hear both sides of the story. Neighborhood peace is shattered. It's the middle of the night. Young faces high in the shadows while they watch their mother and father fight. He says she's been unfaithful. She says her love for him is gone. And the brother shrugs to his sister and says, looks like it's just us from now on. All we always need to hear both sides of the story. We need to hear both sides of the story. And the lights are all on. The world is watching now. People looking for truth. We must not fail now. Be sure before we close our eyes. Been drawn. They've been fighting him this, but now there's killing on the streets. While small coffins are lined up sadly, now united in defeat. All we always need to hear both sides of the story. Well, the lights are all on.
Oh,
So welcome back to Money Talk. This is Simon Webster, and we're looking at pension income drawdown today. Now, we've considered the fact that the ageing population and the falling annuity rate made it particularly attractive for the government to free up the options that people had when taking their money out of a pension. It really is crucial that people feel they've got some flexibility and that they've got an option when they get to retirement to get the sort of income that they need for their savings. Because people have always got to balance what they do with their income today against what they're going to need in the future. And if it's a choice between a decent night out and saving for a nebulous retirement that may never come under terms that may not be terribly attractive, then a lot of people are going to choose the decent night out, which of course is why we've had auto enrolment introduced. But what are the changes going to mean for you and I now? Well, the first thing to bear in mind is that just because pension income drawdown has become hugely more flexible and hugely more attractive, it still won't suit everybody. In fact, at the time of the budget announcement, I had a client come in to see me with a very significant pension pot. And we'd signed up the paperwork for an annuity. And in fact, it was all going through, and then George Osborne stood up and said, you could have this flexible drawdown. So I called the client and said, this is quite a big deal. You ought to come into the office and have a conversation. He brought his wife. And we sat there and went through the pros and cons. And broadly speaking, the pros and cons are fairly straightforward. If you take an annuity, you get a lower income, effectively, but it is effectively guaranteed for life. Now, there are various annuity shapes and profiles that you can choose, and I think we've covered those in a previous show. But effectively, once you've decided what you're going to take, you know that month in, month out, that income will come in. And that is a huge peace of mind for a lot of people. Now, the alternative is to go for income drawdown. Day one, you have the option to take more money. That is obviously attractive to anybody. But there is the possibility that if investment returns are not good, then returns may deteriorate and people's pension incomes could fall over time. How likely that is a matter of debate and conjecture. And of course, we can all be wise after the event, but it's very hard to make even an educated guess in advance. But for this particular couple, the wife in particular, the security of a guaranteed income coming in every month outweighed all other considerations. And I am sure that there will be many other people for whom this will be equally true. However, for a lot of people, probably the majority, the option to be able to strip money out of your pension when you want, how you want, will effectively become the predominant factor. That will outweigh all other considerations. The idea of locking yourself into an annuity at a rate of some 5.5%, where you could only get a maximum of 5.5% for the rest of your life, and you've got to wait effectively 20 years to get that sort of return back, is a lot to consider. And people just say, I really don't want to be in that place. I don't want to be in a situation where I've got to wait 20 years to get my money back. I might not live that long. And it's a very fair point. So the option to be able to take all your money out fairly quickly has huge attractions. But there is tax to consider. And the tax issue is this. If you are receiving a basic state pension, and let's pretend in round figures that's $10,000 a year, then as soon as you have pension drawings of £30,000 or more in a tax year, every pound of income above that is taxed at 40%. Now, to my way of thinking, that is pretty pointless. And so anybody in retirement would be very well advised to so structure their affairs that they never draw out more than, give or take, £40,000 a year income, so that they never have to pay higher rate tax. Now, for a lot of people, they'll be saying, well, I just wish I could possibly be in a position to draw £40,000 out of anything in a year. That would be fantastic. It's two or three times more than I'm earning more at the moment. And if that's the case, then clearly there are going to be implications for planning there. But it's a really important benchmark to bear in mind that there is really no point in taking money out of an investment vehicle that rolls up totally tax-free and bringing it into an environment where you're going to pay higher rate tax, unless you desperately, urgently need the money for something. So it's really important to balance your actual needs with a knee-jerk reaction to that feeling of control one has when the money is in your personal bank account, as opposed to being in some sort of nebulous pension plan. And I suppose that brings me on to the next point, because the reality is we've now got to start thinking of our pension plans as personal bank accounts. Because effectively, irrespective of the tax position, the money is in there and you can take it out. So on that basis, you now have control over your pension fund. You can decide what you want to do, when you want to do it, and how you want to do it. All great. So there is no need to move money from a tax-free environment into a potentially taxable environment unless you actually want to spend the cash. So I think it's very, very, very important indeed to really give how you deal with your pension a considerable amount of thought, and probably very wise to take independent financial advice. I suppose I would say that because I'm an independent financial advisor. But the truth of the matter is we do this all day, every day, and despite that, little wrinkles come up pretty much every day where we have to give things a real difficult bit of research and planning and thought and step out of the box and all this other stuff to really consider what people's options are and what is going to be the optimum result. It's not a straightforward binary decision, annuity or drawdown, because as soon as you go drawdown, you've got a whole host of options. Now, another major strategic planning issue is the balance between the taking of tax-free cash and the taking of taxable income. I may not have mentioned it in this show so far, but you do have the option of drawing money from your pension plan tax-free, and in fact a quarter of the value of your pension plan may be withdrawn as tax-free cash when you get to retirement. Well, in fact, you don't actually have to retire. When you get to age 55, you can take a quarter of your plan out as tax-free cash. And it always used to be the case, when the alternative was to buy an annuity, that in nearly every situation we would say to our clients, we'll take out the maximum tax-free cash and we'll just annuitize the balance. But of course now, the question then becomes, if you take the tax-free cash, or as it's now called, the pension commencement lump sum, out of your pension, what are you actually going to do with the money once you've got it? If the answer is, I'm going to spend it on a cruise or a holiday or improving the house or paying off the mortgage, then the answer is, well, take it then. That's probably a very sensible thing to do. If the answer is, well, I'm going to take it out of my pension and invest it probably in an ISA or something, then my question then becomes, well, why would you do that? Because you're much better off actually leaving that money in your tax-free pension environment, which is exactly the same as a new ISA account or NISA account, in that the money rolls up totally tax-free. So on that basis, you can get your money out of the pension, you can get your money out of the ISA. Why use pension money just to switch pockets when you could put other money into an ISA and you could leave your pension money sitting where it is? So it's a really quite interesting philosophy here about pension extraction, what income extraction, how you take your money out of your plan and what shape you do it. For example, it might be a good idea to say, well, I want an income of £1,000 a month from my pension. It would be great if you could arrange it so that a large part of that £1,000 came out tax-free. And by using part of your tax-free cash and part of your taxable income at the same time, you can actually get that £1,000 a month income coming out of your pension plan in the most tax-efficient manner you possibly can. And there's a lot of sense in doing that. The only problem is there's only about one company that we know of that is yet capable of producing a monthly income on that basis. And if you want to know who it is, tweet the show at moneytalk_guru, or you can email me, that's sw@fffp.co.uk, and I'll give you further information on the plan. But the reality of the situation is there is only this one company that we know of that can do it. And it is a huge opportunity for people to get their money out of their pension in the most tax-efficient way possible. But it's a question of finding a company that's got the IT to back it up to make it happen. Now, if you're approaching retirement sometime between now and March next year, you might decide to ask yourself the question, do I want to take pension benefits now, or can I afford to delay them until March next year? Because if you can afford to delay till March next year, you get the whole panoply of pension benefits kicking in. And it's a very good question. For some people, the decision will make itself. If I stop work, I have no money, I must therefore get a pension income coming in now immediately, or I can't afford to eat. Well, the decision then effectively makes itself. But there'll be a lot of people for whom there might be other investments they could play with, other things they could do with their money. Well, they might be able to actually stay at work for another 6 months and give themselves some extra choices. And that might well be worth considering. But again, it's this planning thing. And I'm afraid it all comes down to, if you don't know the answers, go off and see an independent financial advisor. Dare I say it, come in and see us at Facts and Figures in Ashford. But the reality of the situation is, it is very complicated. I'll give you a silly little, for instance, as a by the by. I had a client come in last week who wanted to set up a small, well, in fact, he wanted a whole panoply of financial advice, and he didn't want to pay for it. This guy actually happened to work for a church charity, and I took the decision that we were going to help this guy on a free of charge basis. So we had a chat for an hour and a half and a cup of coffee, and I was able to give him some suggestions, and he went away reasonably happy knowing what he needed to do. One of the things he needed to do was set himself up a pension, which you can actually do online. So I said, well, go off and buy yourself one of these pensions online. There's three or four companies you could talk to. Go in there and do it. He's come back to me and said, it is so confusing, I don't know what to do. Will you please tell me which pension plan I should buy? The problem I've got now is that as a regulated financial advisor, if I tell him what to do specifically, formally or informally, I'm legally giving financial advice. We have to open a file. I break in huge compliance costs and liabilities. And so far, we've talked to this chap on a free of charge basis. If I do this, I'm effectively making quite a large charitable donation. Now, I don't say that in any way to try and sound very clever. What I'm saying is, it is very complicated out there. And there is a real need for independent financial advice, for people to understand what their options are and make sure they make the right decisions. Even if you've got a relatively modest pension plan of, say, £30,000 or £40,000, if you don't get decent advice about how you take that money out, you could get yourself a fairly significant tax bill that you don't need. Taking advice, even if it's only an hour's consultation, which will cost you, what, £250, it's going to save you a lot of money in the long term. So it's definitely worth having the conversation. Now, when George introduced these changes in the budget, there was a lot of talk about people rushing off and buying Bugattis and Ferraris with their pension funds. There'd be a lot of people with £100,000 in their pots. But as we've already alluded, only 25% of that £100,000 pot comes out tax-free. The other 75% is taxable. Some of it will be taxable at 20%, and for many people that will be a price worth paying. But some of it will be taxable at 40%, or if you're a very high rate taxpayer, will be taxable at higher rates, 45%. And that starts to get very, very expensive. So the question then becomes, is it really worth rushing out and buying a Ferrari or a Bugatti with your pension plan, which would be a wonderful thing to own for 5 minutes, but, big but, it will be hugely detrimental in terms of tax, because all you've got to do is wait until the next tax year and you can take the rest of the money out. So you could take, if you had a £100,000 pot, you might decide, I want to get all my money out, but you're going to do it over 2 or 3 years rather than day one. Either way, George Osborne is currently forecasting that he's going to get a £4 billion tax, tax injection from people taking money out of their pensions that they would not have otherwise done. Accelerated pension income drawdown is going to lead to a £4 billion tax win for the government. So it's well worth really giving this matter some thought. There's huge flexibility. There are a raft of additional options. But with all these options comes difficult decisions, and with difficult decisions comes a need for advice. As an advisor, I would say that, wouldn't I? A point I've made already, but it doesn't alter the fact it's really quite complicated unless you do it for a living, I suppose. So, does Gordon's, or do Gordon's changes make pensions more attractive? I think the short answer to that is one word, too blooming right, or yes, absolutely, pensions are now super attractive. For a higher rate taxpayer with a modest pension plan, the short answer is put your money into a pension plan now, get higher rate tax relief on it immediately, retire, get 25% of your fund out tax free, and then organise your affairs so that you only pay 20% on the income that you draw out in future years. It's an immediate win, a proper manipulation of the tax system. Now, you might say, well, what about putting my money in a NISA? In a NISA, because it's a new ISA now, so it's a NISA. And the question is, well, do you get tax relief on your ISA contributions? And the answer is, you don't. So the money you put into an ISA, you put in out of taxed income. So let's work this through. If you put £1,000 in an ISA and you get 5% return on that ISA money, at the end of a year, you've got £1,050. If you put £1,000 in a pension, you get basic rate tax relief on that money. That's £250. £1,250 is invested. You get 5% growth on that. That's £67. And you end up with £1,300-odd. If you are a higher rate taxpayer, you put £1,000 in a pension, you get £667 worth of tax relief. You get 5% growth on the £1,667. And you end up with over £1,800. Given the choice between an investment that gives you an £1,800 return and one that gives you £1,050, which one do you think you should be taking? And it really is as simple as that. And with that, we'll move to the break.
Jobsinkent.com.
We don't have to worry about nothing, 'cause we got the fire and we're burning one hell of a something. They're gonna see us from outer space, light it up like we're the stars of the human race, human race. When the lights turn it down, they don't know what they heard. Strike the marsh, pray it loud.
Giving love.
Cause we got the fire, fire, fire. Yeah, we got the fire, fire, fire. And we're gonna let it burn, 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 burn. We're gonna let it burn.
And welcome back to Hagelands. This is Simon Webster. This is Money Talk on Channel Radio. You can tweet the show on moneytalk_guru. You can email in any questions to sw@fffp.co.uk. That's fffp.co.uk. Or you can actually get some more information on the pension subjects that we've been covering today at the Facts and Figures website at www.fffp.co.uk. And the really exciting news for those that are that way inclined is that I am delighted to say that we are nearly up and running with the Money Talk website, which I'm very excited about because it has been a very, very, very long time coming. But for a whole host of reasons, it's proved to be challenging to get us to the point that we can actually put this thing live, but we are hopeful that it's going to go up very shortly. So, next we're going to cover financial news. And the big question that we often cover on this show is what is going to happen to interest rates? It was published this week that there are serious concerns in the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England that now may be the time to start nudging rates up, and one or two pundits are predicting that rates will move in November of this year. The minutes of the Monetary Policy Committee come out in about 10 days' time, and in 10 days' time we will hear whether or not there is a split decision on keeping rates as is, which was the decision at the last meeting earlier this week. So at the moment, interest rates are 0.5%. Bank of England base rate is 0.5%. But we are waiting to see where that's going to go over the course of the next few months. And anybody with a mortgage is going to be hugely interested in this, because if Bank of England base rate goes up by even a quarter of a percent, there is a chance that mortgage interest rates will nudge up a little bit. And savers will be hugely interested because they've been getting derisory returns from cash for a long time. And they are thinking it's our turn, it's our time. We should now be getting a halfway decent return from our cash going forward. And it's time that we started to see some halfway sensible returns. And of course, what actually happens over the next few months is going to have a profound impact on the economy. Because as we've often debated on this show, the big problem is, while a rise in interest rates will be very good news for savers, we've already said that mortgage borrowers will be concerned, but the real question is, what is going to happen to business confidence? Because businesses need to borrow money in order to expand their businesses, and the low interest rates have helped encourage business activity in the recession and helped drag us out of a very, very difficult economic period that we've had over the last few years. And as soon as they start going up, businesses are start going to be concerned about what they're going to do with their investment plans going forward. As soon as businesses think it's going to cost us real money to invest going forward and rates are going up, what is going to happen to them in the future? Mm-hmm. There is going to be a concern, and as soon as there's concern, businesses like stability, as soon as they've got some sort of concern there, then they're going to have to start changing their plans. And anything that happens along those lines may well cause some form of slowdown in the economy, and there's a real issue there. Another piece of news that came in during the course of the week, which is also sourced from the Bank of England, is that care home costs have gone up 54% more than pensioner incomes. The annual cost of a room in a care home has increased by £299 on average over the last year, 54% more than the average £194 income gain enjoyed by pensioners over the same period, according to Prestige Nursing Care Plus. The average cost of a single room in the UK residential care home has risen to £28,666 a year, more than double the average pensioner's income of £13,993, leaving older people facing an income shortfall of £282 a week, or £14,673 annually, if they need to pay for residential care. That is a huge, huge shortfall. And providing for long-term care is something that I think all of us need to think about, because if you don't deal with it, you're going to get a very nasty surprise when you get to retirement. And I think people have got, well, when you come in to need long-term care. And I think we all need to give this some very serious thought. I always like being the bearer of good news on this show, but I can't help it. That's just the way the thing crumbles.
Temp Network have hundreds of vacancies across West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay, and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531-777.
Let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
You walked with me, footprints in the sand, and helped me understand where I'm going. You walked with me when I was all alone, with so much unknown along the way. Then I heard you say, I promise you, I'm always there. When your heart is filled with sorrow and despair, I'll carry you when you need a friend. Footprints in the sand. I see my life flash across the sky. So many times have I been so afraid. And just when I thought I lost my way, you gave me strength to carry on. That's when I heard you say, I promise to you, I'm always there. When your heart is filled with sorrow and despair, and I'll carry you
That was Leona Lewis. She's a real star. We're on to news in Money Talk, and it would be ridiculous to not cover one or two of the world issues that are now facing us and that will have a profound impact on everybody's finances in the weeks and months to come. The two areas that really concern me at the moment are Russia and the Ukraine, and then Iraq and the rise of the caliphate that is the new Islamic State that's been proclaimed over in Arab regions. Dealing with Russia first, Mr. Putin decided, we understand, that he wanted to annex part of Ukraine, which has gone by almost unnoticed. And there is increasing instability in other parts of Ukraine, allegedly at Mr. Putin's behest, and Russia is hoping to extend its influence further in that area. Now, the truth of the matter is, I don't know enough about the history and the people involved in this area to really have an opinion on the rights and wrongs of the situation. What I do know is it is having a profoundly destabilizing effect on world markets. First off, Europe and America decided that Putin had promoted and, if not actively assisted, the Ukrainian revolt, or whatever you want to call it, unrest. And as such, he has supplied weapons, and there is talk that Russia was indirectly behind the downing of a civilian airliner less than a couple of weeks ago. And Putin is behind that, and the net result of that is that the Europeans and the Americans impose sanctions on Russia. Now, that sounds like a good thing. Putin does bad stuff, the West responds. But I was listening on the radio only this morning to fishermen saying they've got fish that is currently sitting in warehouses in Russia awaiting import into the country that is now being frozen, left in one place as opposed to frozen in temperature terms, and may well go off while this is sorted out. And they're going to lose tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds, and these sort of losses are enough to bring the business to its knees, and perhaps if it goes on longer term, to bankrupt the business altogether. And then the Russians have announced tit-for-tat sanctions that has meant that UK imports are being restricted, and the whole situation is getting very, very unsettled. As a result of that, the UK stock market, which was tracking just under 6.8, is looking at about 6.5 at the moment, which is a really sad turn of events for investors. Meanwhile, in Syria, the country seems to go from bad to worse, and the instability that's there and has moved across into Iraq has meant that huge numbers of people have been made homeless. Apparently, Christians are running for their lives in places where the Muslim extremists have been threatening to kill people that don't convert immediately. Now, this is the sort of thing that used to happen in Western worlds hundreds of years ago. It is sad that today, in our more enlightened times, as we like to think of it, these things are going on. Again, don't know a huge amount about the ins and outs of the politics, but the reality is business and markets like stability. They like things to be even. They like to know what's going to happen next. And when you have wars and instability, it's very hard to predict. Will there be sanctions? Will it impact on the oil price, which is the big scare for many Western countries? What will this mean for their prices, for input prices on manufacturing? And it makes it very hard for businesses to plan. Businesses need nice, steady growth they like. They need a benign tax regime. They need a ready workforce. and they need stable customer bases, markets that they can access. And as soon as you have a situation where these things are thrown up in the air by a variety of things that are going on at the moment, then you have a situation where business doesn't know which way to go, market confidence is eroded, prices fall, investor returns are hurt, and you get into sort of a downward cycle that is very difficult for people to cope with. So where does that leave us going forward? Well, at Facts and Figures, we have always said that putting all your money in stocks and shares is a bad idea, just as putting all your money into gilts is a bad idea. The number one rule for investment is diversification. The number two rule for investment is diversification. The number three rule for investment is diversification. And the more you diversify your holdings, the better protected you are against huge vagaries in the market. Now, when the recession kicked in big time 6 years ago, then every market went south. There wasn't much anybody could do about it. But I always remember the 1970s, and sadly I am old enough to remember the 1970s, when for many years we'd had a benign period, stock market had done really well, and then overnight the price of oil was doubled. That meant all the uncertainty and lack of confidence in business markets that I've been talking about earlier suddenly came to the fore, and the stock market plummeted almost literally overnight. And there was a very long, very sharp bear run. And a lot of people who have been buying stocks and shares on a short-term basis, which, by the way, is never a good idea, suddenly found that they'd lost their shirts. And they were in serious trouble. And as I sometimes say in seminars, there was blood up and down Wall Street and across the city of London as people in shiny suits were jumping out of windows because they'd lost so much money they had no hope of getting it back. But only 3 years later, there was a huge improvement in the market. And people who invested at the beginning of 1972 suddenly found that by end of 1974, beginning of 75, they were back to where they'd started. And that put them in a much better position. So diversification is one thing, holding for the longer term is the other. And if you can get those two things right between you, then hopefully, you'll get halfway decent returns going forward. It's been a pleasure spending this hour with you. My name is Simon Webster. This has been Money Talk. If you want to get information on anything that we've covered today, then go on to the Money Talk website. Go to www.fffp.co.uk. Tweet the show, moneytalk_guru, or email me personally, sw@fffp.co.uk. Have a great week. I'll speak to you next week.